Hello, and thank you for tuning in to Voices from Room. On this podcast, writers, poets, activists, artists, and analysts who have contributed to Room talk about their work, themselves, and the complex problems our world faces. We hope you'll join us on Thursday, July 13th over Zoom for our annual summer gala. This year, we are thrilled to recognize the exceptional contributions of Deborah Dancy, Kareem Dejani, and the Psychotherapy Action Network, abbreviated as CYAN, who we will be speaking with today. These honorees' innovative work and leadership propel the spirit of Room's interdisciplinary, transformative mission forward. My name is Isaac Sloan, and I'm joined by Aneta Stojnich. Hi, Aneta.
Hi, Isaac, and everyone who's listening. It is my great pleasure and honor to welcome our two wonderful guests today, Linda Michaels and Janice Moore. They are co-founders of CYAN, an organization that will be honored at the upcoming Room Gala on July 13th, and we'll hear about that some more in a minute. But let me introduce our guests first. Linda Michaels is a psychologist in private practice in Chicago. In addition to being co-founder of Psychotherapy Action Network, CYAN, she is a consulting editor of Psychoanalytic Inquiry, clinical associate faculty at the Chicago Center for Psychoanalysis, and a fellow of Lauder Institute Global MBA program. With a former career in marketing, innovation, and management consulting, she has over 15 years of experience consulting with organizations in the U.S. and Latin America. In addition to her doctorate degree in clinical psychology from Illinois School of Professional Psychology, Linda is a graduate of Chicago Psychoanalytic Institute's Psychoanalytic Psychotherapy Program. And she also has MBA from Wharton and BA from Harvard. She has previously served as a president of a nonprofit performing arts organization. Janice Moore is a clinical psychologist in private practice in Chicago. She is a treasurer and co-founder of Psychotherapy Action Network, CYAN, and her interest in mental health grew out of an early brief career teaching high school English. She is currently serving as a clinical associate faculty at the Chicago Center for Psychoanalysis. She has received her PhD from Northwestern University, where she served as an adjunct clinical faculty in the counseling psychology program for 18 years. Welcome, Linda and Janice. And maybe we could really start. We usually start with connection that our guests have to Room. And maybe we could really start from there. And could you tell us a little bit about the collaboration between CYAN and Room, or the relationship between CYAN and Room?
Janice, why don't you go first?
Well, as organizations, we coincidentally started at a similar time. And I think that we were at different, we had different approaches to trying to address the same problems that we were seeing in the larger mental health system, in our practices, and in the social context that we were functioning in, and felt the need for developing a stronger community and a stronger voice. CYAN actually grew out of a conference that was held at the end of January 2017. It was sponsored by the Chicago Center for Psychoanalysis, and that conference and the arc of the content of that conference has really sustained us in our overall perspective on what we want to accomplish and our mission and what we're communicating to our members and our three audiences, which are the public, our profession, and policymakers.
Linda, would you like to add something to that?
Thanks so much for having us. We're just so delighted to be here, and we're really honored to have joined Room's masthead. I think it's given both of our organizations such a boost, and people have been so excited to see that we're connected and in these important ways. And yes, I mean, we're, you know, very concerned with the marginalization of depth therapies. We've coined a phrase of therapies of depth, insight, and relationship to describe a number of different therapies that share similar values and approaches to the work, and have been similarly pushed out in favor of shorter term quick fixes. And we really want there to be more room for these therapies, for therapists to practice them, for patients to access them, for the public to, and policymakers to understand their benefits. You know, we're not saying these are the only therapies that people need, far from it, but they need to be available to those who do need them in the cases when other therapies don't work. And they need this kind of treatment. And our organization is unique, I think, in that it's multidisciplinary. We've smashed all the silos and brought together psychologists, social workers, marriage and family therapists, counselors, psychiatrists, and folks from many, many different theoretical orientations. And I think that's really part of our strength that has helped us to grow from, very humble conference to now over 5,500 individual members and over 90 organizational members.
I know there was a conference that was almost 3 years after the conference that Cyan sprung from. I'm talking about the Rehumanizing Mental Health Policy and Practice Conference in December of 2019. More recently, you put out a book called Advancing Psychotherapy for the Next Generation. In both the book and the program for the conference, there's more than just advocating for in-depth psychotherapy. There are panels and papers about lawmaking, insurance, education, and research, all as they pertain to psychotherapy. There is really a lot of educating Cyan and you both do around what's at stake for mental health policy and practice. Can you say more about the wider scope of educating Cyan does around these issues?
We have lately been talking more about using the term clinical advocates for what we are trying to create, and which really is a shift in our identities as clinicians. That we do more than the work that we do in our offices, but we must attend to the context in which we're working. And so these arenas that you're describing, the laws that affect how we practice, insurance companies are doing to manage how we practice, the research that's being done that underlies what good practice is, and the marketplace, which is a huge factor and only becoming larger in the last number of years, that shapes how we practice, whether we like it or not. So we feel that we need to be aware of this. We need to educate our members to be more aware of all of this. And so we both speak to a larger audience to address some of these issues that come up. And in that process, are hoping to educate and teach our members to do the same, so that we have a much stronger voice and can take leadership in shaping a mental health system that's more humane and effective.
Yes, and we certainly understand that an advocacy role might not be the most comfortable fit for most clinicians, particularly those who are in private practice and used to working, you know, very soft, closed, intimate spaces. But we really think of our advocacy work as a way to embrace the turn to the social and the community and the relational that our field is undergoing, you know, more theoretically every day. And that, you know, we cannot operate in a vacuum in our consulting rooms, either from a theoretical perspective or in this broader sense. And we have to become more attuned and more active in the social, political, and economic context in which we operate, which is kind of was the first day of our conference and the first section of our book. And then, you know, Isaac, as you had mentioned, we do go into different aspects and qualities of why these depth therapies are so unique and valuable, and also outline our original research that we've done with the public, sort of bringing back my consulting market research days. A colleague, Santiago Delbois, and I have done some market research with the public that we're fielding again this summer. And we were just amazed and delighted when we asked the public open-endedly, what do they want from therapy? And the majority, 70% or so, said that they want to get to the root of their problems. Mm-hmm. And they want more self-awareness and understanding. And also that they view therapy as an investment, not only as a process in and of itself that is worthwhile, but more fundamentally that they are worth investing in themselves. And also, pretty shockingly, over 90% said that they would prefer a therapy that helps them get to the root causes of their symptoms, even if that therapy takes longer. So I think in many ways, people, you know, of course, have, you know, that desire for a quick fix, which I can certainly empathize with. But truly, they do understand that these problems, which they perhaps have been dealing with for years, decades, even generations, do not have a quick fix, and that they are really worth investing in themselves to figure themselves out.
Thank you for saying that. I think you're getting into something really important with these findings that you're sharing with us about people really wanting to get to the root of their problem and understanding themselves as worth of investment. And I don't find that surprising at all. I think that in a way the whole quick fix is something that is being put out there, and you know, like if that's what is offered, and if mm-hmm. that's what is advertised, then kind of like people learn to think about quick fix as a way to go, but really our patients need to have the in-depth approach that we are really advocating for, and that your work is dedicated to advocating. So I think that's a really important point that you're.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I think you're exactly right, Annetta. And in some senses, it does make perfect sense, and we can appreciate that the people really want, you know, to understand themselves and make their ways through life. However, yes, what is being marketed to them in terms of ways to do that by people who have a lot of money to advertise, to impact insurance policy, to, you know, also market pharmaceuticals and other things that we might put more in the quick fix category. And venture capitalists who are funding new apps every day. The messages people are truly bombarded with are very different. Mm-hmm. And we're very concerned about that. And, you know, actually the article that I wrote for Room that's coming out soon, I believe, was about our experience of standing up for this in a pretty big way to Talkspace. And their response was to send us a couple of cease and desist letters, and then a few weeks later file suit, and for $40 million. So this is their strategy, is to advertise products and services that, you know, compromise patient confidentiality, put therapists in dual roles, and many other things we were really alarmed about. All without an evidence base, and their response was just to silence us. Mm-hmm. And they had the money to do that.
Yeah.
However, we prevailed. So hopefully everyone can read more about that in the next issue.
Yeah, I actually wanted to ask you if you want to say a bit. It will it's in an upcoming issue, and our readers will certainly have have a chance to read it. But if you want to say more about the article that you wrote and these things that you are bringing up now, because it's an extremely important topic.
Yeah, I mean, it was probably one of the scariest times that I think we've all had recently, and certainly for Cyan. Yes, we wrote a letter of concern to the American Psychological Association about Talkspace and some of the problems that we saw with their products, with their marketing messages, and then subsequently with their partnership with United Behavioral Health, which had been the target of a large class action lawsuit, where United was found to be making coverage decisions based on the input of their finance directors, as opposed to what treatment did this patient actually need and what did their insurance policy actually cover. So we were alarmed about all these things and wrote to the APA. And with later that same day, we heard from the Talkspace lawyers. So you'll have to read the article to find out why there was that quick response from Talkspace. Just a couple of weeks after that cease and desist letter, without giving us a chance to respond, they quickly filed a lawsuit and sued us, Cyan, and the co-founders as individuals, which was horrifying, for defamation and libel and damages to their business to the tune of $40 million. And we had, I think at that time, we had about $5,000 in the bank. We have a lot more now, but at that time, we just had a few thousand dollars. And then a few weeks after that, the lawyers that we did have on hand resigned. And so we were really stuck, but we were able to find some pro bono representation, which was fantastic, from Arnold and Porter in New York, and who took us on as a free speech issue that we had the right to voice our opinions about their service. And Talkspace since has been having a lot of problems. They're right now being sued by people who invested in them when they went public, and once again for misrepresentation. I'm not surprised, but a class of investors who invested in their public offering is suing Talkspace now for misrepresenting their financials. So this is a long history with this company. I'm very glad that we prevailed in court, but yeah, it was definitely one of the scariest moments professionally and personally that I think all of us have had in a very long time.
One of the things that was stunning about it for me was that all we had done was write a letter to the APA. It was a professional communication of concern. And the idea that we could be harassed in this way for something that was essentially a professional discussion. It isn't that we sent it out to newspapers. It isn't that we made a huge public statement, but they went after us in this way anyway. The other thing I was thinking about with Talkspace is that one of the things that they did was that they claimed an evidence base for what they were doing. And they advertised this heavily on their website because they did some research sort of in-house. And so it's a classic problem of researcher bias. And it's a very typical problem that's permeated not just businesses like Talkspace, but our field, unfortunately, where a great deal of what's called evidence-based is really, you know, small studies conducted by researchers or companies so that they can have some data that they can then claim to be evidence-based. And this is one of the issues that we see broadly and that we try to address.
Thank you for your work, really, in that area. And it's a horrifying story what happened with you and Talkspace. And really, I invite everyone to read your article in the next issue of in the upcoming issue of Room. And in a way, it really what happened to you really demonstrates what happens when mental health is treated as industry, you know, and when we're
Yes.
part of industry. And maybe we could say something about that as well, because in a way, psychoanalysis and in-depth therapies do stand in a position in its essence by what they're offering. As a long-term treatment, as a long-term investment, as something that as a process based on relationship that develops over time, that kind of like structurally stand against this capitalist idea of mental health as industry.
I do think, this is something that we're talking about a lot at Cyan right now, because we do also recognize that there is a huge access problem and a shortage of therapists for people who need help. And so, there are also ways to use psychoanalytic approaches and concepts with some more scale than just a one-on-one multi-year treatment. So we're talking about that. But also, yes, when the industry aspect, the capitalist aspect gets involved, it's really concerning. A lot of these technology companies that are advertising all over on NPR, on the internet, in all the media, are founded and run by venture capitalists. And their model is to seek out industries where they think they have an opportunity to disrupt that, to invest, to make some money. They don't even really have to turn a profit. They just have to be able to show some numbers to get enough other people to invest and then sell their business and move on to the next industry after they exit the first one. So this is the model, and this is what we're, contending with. Even though people say they want to get to the root of their problems, looking out at all the solutions that are available to them, that are marketed to them, how would they know where to go to do that? How would they find the right place to get the kind of help they want? It's very unclear. And that is one of the big projects that we are working on right now this summer, is leveraging our market research with the public to build new tools and a new website for the public, so that we can explicitly educate them on the spectrum, the range of treatment options that are out there. It won't only say this is depth therapy, everyone should do depth therapy. It will not say that, but we want to educate them so they're more informed. And then we will have a resource of depth therapy. We will have a database of depth therapy resources that they can access. And this will be resources for folks at all income levels. And there are ways for folks with fewer resources to still access quality care. And so we're hoping that this will offer a counterpoint to a lot of the messages that are out there. And it would be wonderful for our entire community to get behind this and support this and participate in it, because I think collectively we have to show the public that there are other options than what these large companies are advertising.
A few weeks ago we had Keiko Lane on the podcast, who is a queer psychotherapist from California with a background in activism. And she talked about how activism is at once so exciting and emboldening and at the heart of what she and many others are focused on, and yet it can be very exhausting and very difficult to confront a feeling of being tired or needing to take a step back. In the Talkspace instance, it's so striking. Obviously, that is a kind of unimaginable and wild instance your organization faced. You know, I'm wondering, as you're talking about educating the public and ousting these things about research or policy making, you know, I know in my experience there can be a real divide between people who really, really get what's at stake and really understand the nuances that Cyan is bringing to the table around this, and others who struggle to comprehend what's at stake. Even if someone can grasp why an in-depth therapy may be worthwhile, there can be a feeling like, oh, it's just kind of the way of the world, or a worry about how to move forward or something like that. And I find that exhausting to engage with. I'm wondering about your experience of that and also how you stay the course.
Tough question, Isaac. I think that for me, I always come back to the idea of the community of people that I'm working with as sustaining. And am really so aware that that's also what we want to promote within the organization and more broadly, socially. It's what we need to have in a mental health system. We don't have that. We have a lot of competing voices and agendas, people who are trying to get their pieces of the pie, whether it's financially or professional status, and all of those things battle against a sense of community. But I think with Cyan, what ebbs and flows for me around what's sustaining is whether there are enough people that I can be in conversation with who care about the same things and are making some efforts. And when I see that happening, that keeps me going. And when it's not happening, I wonder how long I can keep going.
Yeah, I definitely echo what Janice is saying. And just to let everyone know, we do all of this totally pro bono. Our day job, we're therapists, so we are working in private practice during the week, during the day. And so somehow we have managed to do this in the evenings, on the weekends, in between when there's a cancellation. So yes, we've been at this for 6 years, and it is heartening. One thing, as Janice was saying as well, that sustains me is how much we've grown, and new people are coming in, even if they, you know, don't know the full range of issues, as you were saying, Isaac, but perhaps they've run into some barrier or obstacle with an insurance company for one of their patients, and they've gotten, you know, frustrated or fired up about that and done some digging and have learned about us. And we've grown so much, and we have this year actually hired our first person to work at Cyan. That means our first paid person, even though we have many, many volunteers. And we've established a board, and we have a great roster of advisors who really believe in the organization and our mission. And so that, I think, is, it's really gaining momentum, and hopefully we'll continue forward just as strongly. But yes, it's difficult because this has certainly been, well, like Room, a labor of love.
Well, to bring it to a personal level, I wanted to say that I took an undergraduate course that surveyed the different methods and practices that exist under the umbrella of mental health. And I went on to co-teach that during my master's. And if I didn't have this course that was really saying there are these many methodologies and this issue of hierarchy, I don't think I would really understand what this is all about. I think I might have had some kind of chip on my shoulder about psychoanalysis being the best, but it's actually really helped to frame this, that there is an approach to looking at these practices critically that's very important. And one of the times I was teaching the course, I actually found Cyan. It was probably 2018, and I brought it into the class. I kind of taught it as something that was attempting to address how what we were learning about in the classroom was manifesting out in the world. And there was a lot of interest. I still have students write to me who took that course and say, you know, it's really shaped my decision when looking for a therapist, or, you know, the route I took to pursuing higher education on the path to becoming a therapist. And it's just amazing to see these kinds of efforts in action in the world.
Thank you. That's so
That's
cool.
that is great. Yeah.
That's
Yeah,
great.
we are a couple things it brings to mind for me. One is that currently we're working on a webinar we have been informally calling Cyan 101. We've been putting together our education materials for a while, and we've recently connected with a certificate program at Loyola in Chicago, Loyola University, and this will be offered as part of their curriculum. I think we're working on a date in the spring, and it will also be available more broadly. It'll be available for CEs, and so we're hoping to take this material that you, and it's wonderful, have used for such a long time, and make it more package it in a way that it's really easily accessible to students and to programs. And the other thing that we would love to see is to have our book adopted as a textbook for grad students, because we think it covers a range of topics that are crucial for people who are entering the field to understand, as you say, and to have a better grasp of the bigger picture that they're operating in. And without that, they are so vulnerable to it's exactly the same as our political system, I think. Without an education, without an attitude toward as being an informed citizen, how in the world do we truly understand the pressures on us, and how do we make good decisions about how to operate in the world that we're in?
You mentioned at the beginning how unfortunately advocacy oftentimes doesn't come naturally to many of our colleagues, and people shy away from taking up these roles that you have taken up strongly and publicly. And I'm wondering whether since you started Cyan, whether it in any way influenced your practice, either kind of personally, in a way how you approach your work as therapists, or maybe whether like your patients know are aware of the work that you're doing. Have you had such feedback within your practice?
It's a really interesting question, Annetta. And I would say yes, it certainly has influenced my work in particular with some people who are more aware. A couple of cases, for example, one, I was interviewed by the New York Times for a large feature story they did on insurance coverage using the city of Chicago, which is where we're both based, as a prime example, because the city of Chicago was one of the governments that took advantage of a loophole that was available to them for parity, meaning that the city of Chicago said, we are not going to follow the law of parity. We are not going to offer equal and comparable insurance coverage to mental health as we do for physical health on the insurance plans that we have for all the City of Chicago employees. So, teachers, firefighters, police, 911 operators. And this was during the height of the pandemic when these were literally the people going out and risking their lives for the community. And the New York Times did a story on this. On the issue of parity, and use the city of Chicago as a prime example of these loopholes and the impacts on people when they did not have comparable mental health insurance coverage. And one of my former patients, who was very riled up herself personally about this, she had switched insurance plans from a more comprehensive plan to the City of Chicago plan and was shocked at how terrible the coverage was. And there were some delicate conversations we had, and we certainly processed it a lot, but she wanted to be interviewed by the reporter by the journalist, and after she finished treatment with me, and she was. And so she's quoted in that article as well. And so that was certainly something we had to talk about. And I thought a lot about whether to even bring that up to her or not. But she was actually very excited to do that and to help be an advocate, you know, in that way for other people, because she felt she was so upset with the limited coverage that was available to her. And I have had another patient who with some problems with out-of-network insurance coverage, it looked like there might be a class action lawsuit that could come of that. And so she also wanted to pursue that. And so I talked with her about that. So I think, you know, not maybe globally with all patients, but I think with some patients, I have taken more risks in bringing up these kinds of topics more directly with them. And some on their own have found that, oh, you wrote a book. tell me about that. And I'm not quite sure how they found out, but they have. And I think they're some of them who have mentioned it to me, at least, have said that they are really reassured to know that their therapist is thinking of these broader issues and shows the care and concern and, you know, wants from a broader level, not just as their personal therapist, but wants the system to be better. And they really appreciate kind of that that extra work that they perceive me doing out in the world.
This is on a different level, but one of the things we did broadly last fall during the Medicare re-enrollment period or enrollment period was to get very busy about getting information out about Medicare Advantage plans and try to help clinicians to talk to their patients about what plans they were signing up for, to push back against the big Medicare Advantage tidal wave that's taking over Medicare from traditional Medicare. And so this is, I think, one of the things that's a kind of issue that often will come up within the therapy frame that doesn't involve anybody going outside and talking to anybody publicly, but that sort of particular advocacy that we can do with patients to help them to find their way through the system and to figure out what their needs are actually are, and not just be stuck with reading whatever the marketer has put out to them to try to sell what they have to sell.
Well, thank you both so much. I'm really looking forward to the Room Gala on July 13th, where we will celebrate your work as activists and therapists and community organizers and educators around these very important aspects of our field and our society and so much more, as you've talked with us about today.
Oh, thank you so much. We are just really so honored and humbled by that. So we're really looking forward to the gala as well. And yeah, thank you so much for the conversation today, Isaac and Annetta. It's been wonderful.
Thank you for all the important work that you're doing.
Thank you so much. This has been great. And yes, and the work that you're doing is wonderful. And I love having the opportunity to sort of step back and reflect that I think that Room provides the space in which isn't as much trying to put something out, which is what we're doing, but to be able to stop and think and relate to these ideas on a different level.
We hope you enjoyed this week's episode and that you'll join us for our virtual gala on Thursday, July 13th at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Room is a grassroots community project which is free for all but does rely on the support of listeners and readers like you to keep us going. To find out more, visit us online at analytic-room.com. Submissions for the next issue of our magazine are open from now until September 1st, and more information about how to send us your work is also available on our website. Thank you.